Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring. Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Colm O'Mungoyne here. If you want to get in touch, 08457 853333 from the north or abroad, 087 484 8888 for your WhatsApps, 51551 by text, joe@rte.ie for emails, or 0818715815 for the live line. JJ Casey, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you doing today?
Good, yeah. It was sad to hear about poor Francis yesterday. It was sad because on Sunday we saw him, and over the Easter we thought that he'd come through all that. It was very sad to hear about him yesterday.
All right. And you saw him, you were watching him on the telly on Sunday, were you? But you'd seen him up close before.
Yeah, myself and my lovely wife, Marion, we went to Rome 3 years ago, and we met him there. All the wedding couples were due to meet him, and we were one of those. And it was just incredible to meet him. We're both mass-going Catholics. We both read at Mass, and just to meet him was an absolute privilege.
And you arrived there. Did you get married in Rome, and did you go straight from the wedding?
No, we got married in Galway, in Rova Church in East Galway, and we went to Rome for our honeymoon, and my lovely wife Marion, she had organized tickets so that we were part of all the wedding group to meet the Pope. And we actually thought, because we went down to St. Peter's Square about 6 o'clock in the morning in the glorious sunshine in Rome, and we were waiting a couple of hours, and we thought the Pope, he might have been too weak to meet us, because he couldn't really walk too far. But we stayed for 3 or 4 hours, and we finally got to meet the Pope. And in my limited Italian, I said to Pope Francis, "Grazie per tutto," which means thanks for everything. So it was amazing to meet him.
And did he hear you?
He did, I think, yeah, he did. He just smiled. He smiled back. He didn't really say, he didn't say a lot. The sun was sort of in his face and stuff, but just to shake his hand, and especially when I think of him, since he became Pope and all the changes that had happened in the church, and he was a Pope that was less interested in the trappings of the institutional church, but more about reaching out to the poor, the marginalized, and the dispossessed. So he's someone, you know, I'm a Catholic, and I think he's been probably the best Pope that we could have had. And probably people that are not even Catholic, they follow him as well, because he comes across as a very great Pope, interested in the suffering of human beings.
And can you tell us what did it mean to you? Can you describe maybe the impact on you at the time, as you know you could see he was coming, you were getting to shake his hand? I mean, talk us through the build up to the moment. Were you nervous? Were you tense?
My wife and my wife Marion and I was suited and booted, and my wife was in her white wedding dress that she wore, you know, on the day that I'm married in Rova. And I suppose we go to church in Rova, and there's a big picture of Pope Francis there on the wall. So each time we go to Mass, his picture is also there. So, you know, the significance of meeting him and all his writings over the last couple of years, and the way he talked about the world, and of what he was saying, like, who am I to judge? I am a sinner. So he was reaching out to everybody and just waiting for those few hours to meet him in Rome. It was just in glorious sunshine in Rome. And then to finally see him, it was, the impact is going to stay with us forever.
And what did you do afterwards? Did you need to go and decompress, or after all the sunshine and the standing around in the suit, as you say, suited and booted, did you need to sit down? Did you need a bit of recovery time after meeting him?
We did, yeah. We did. We walked around Rome, and we got something to eat, and just the glow from both of us just meeting him, and was just... And when I think he died now yesterday, that memory of just meeting him, shaking his hand, and just being in his presence was something now that we'll never forget.
And what was your reaction when you'd heard he died? Did you feel, you know, given that you'd shaken his hand and you'd met him, how did you feel when you heard the news?
I suppose, you know, Easter is a big... is a big part of being a Catholic, Good Friday, Easter Monday, and then when he came out in St. Peter's Square on Sunday, we thought that he was on the road to recovery, and then when I heard he died on Monday, it was absolutely, it was so sad, you know, it was so sad. And, you know, when I think of Pope Francis, you think of the love he had for people. And when you think, you know, he wants to support the poor, the dispossessed, the marginalized. He was all for climate change. And now he's gone. You'll be thinking of what other world leaders are out there who are going to fight for what he fought for. So... You would be even thinking within the next couple of years or the next decade who is going to fight for all those people like Pope for Francis did.
Your line's a bit breaking up a little bit there, JJ, but in your thoughts on what you'd like to see next, would you like to see someone continue in the same vein, or would you like to see an emphasis put on some other aspect of the church's teaching or Christian teaching generally?
I suppose, Colm, you would like to continue the work that all he has done so far in terms of his reaching out to people, in terms of popes maybe before him who are a bit more conservative. I suppose we'd like, as a Catholic myself, a pope in the same ilk as Pope Francis to continue the messages that he wanted to bring to the world.
Okay, your line is fading a bit there, JJ, but thanks for joining us. Apologies there for the quality of the line, but thanks for sharing that lovely experience you had. Dennis Bradley, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
You'd be a familiar voice to people for your work in the peace process, but you're a former priest yourself. You look at, I suppose, this with an expert eye to some degree. What are your thoughts on Pope Francis's death?
Well, I would question the expert, but I suppose I'm like other people. I was a bit saddened by his death too, but not too much. I think that someone described it this morning as that there was a feeling of gratitude for his life, for his efforts, and I would have felt some of that too. I think he tried hard. I think that he was a fascinating character in many ways, very flawed like the rest of us, and he was prepared to say that and prepared to live that. I think that one of the fascinating aspects of him is his time in Argentina, his relationship with his fellow priests. And I think that I watched a documentary a few nights ago, and it seems to have run through some of the writings of the people who knew him intimately. And certainly it was in that well-known film called The Two Popes. It kind of, there was a theme of that in it too, that he had felt that people thought that he had betrayed some of his fellow Jesuits in Argentina to the disruption, political disruption and violence that was happening in the country at the time. And that in many ways he carried that burden and that feeling that that in some ways things hadn't worked out the way he wanted them to, and that maybe he carried some of the guilt of that. I'm not too sure, and I don't know if anybody's too clear on all of that. But I think it made him an enigmatic character in many ways, that he was, I think, perhaps emotionally fairly conservative, but that he was incredibly conscious and grew into a consciousness of the limitations of power and the corruption of power. I think that he was aware of the deep flaws in the human condition and the need for compassion, for mercy, for forgiveness, for understanding. And I think that he portrayed some of that within his own, within his ministry as Pope. And I think that was good for the Catholic Church. It kind of, in some ways, pulled it out of the morass that it had allowed itself to sink into. So I think that he had the right to die. I think he had the right to go. I think it was a good time. He obviously had carried some illnesses for a long period of time as well. And now we look forward to the future. When I say we look forward to the future, I don't think that we're going to be very clear and won't be very clear for a long period of time.
Sure.
Legacy that he's left.
There's plenty of speculation about the names that come left. But, I mean, I suppose to assess his skills in the public domain of, you know, putting values front and centre of his time as Pope. I mean, you've come across a lot of people who would have been bridge builders in their time. He was regarded as somebody who wanted to build bridges between the communities maybe in Europe and newly arrived migrants, between the poor and people who were better off. I mean, what would your thoughts be on those aspects of his public communication and the emphasis that he put on where he went, where he visited and where he appointed cardinals?
Well, I think all of those were important. I think they were insightful in the sense that the issue of emigration is one of the world's great both sins in some ways and challenges. Sin in the sense that, you know, it didn't happen accidentally that the poor of the world mostly reside in the southern hemispheres and the rich mostly reside in the northern hemisphere, and that we are now kind of reaping the consequences of that because we have neglected that for so long. And I think Francis was pointing that out in almost in the first act that he did, in the sense that he went to the small island and talked about people dying and being drowned in the Mediterranean, that kind of sea that perhaps separates the south from the north. His appointment of the cardinals, I think, was interesting because I was in Rome for actually 5 or 6 years, and it was very dominated by the Italians. Some people liked that. I remember having a couple of good friends who said, oh, the Italians are very good at this type of stuff, very good at understanding the church and the church's needs. I didn't particularly feel that. And I think that the spread that he showed and the insightfulness of actually appointing people from what were called the far ends of the world and the forgotten parts of the world quite often, I think, was actually a good thing. And I suppose one of the fears was that he lived under the cloud of a possible schism within the church, and that hasn't fully gone away. I mean, this thing between the conservatives and the liberals, it's symptomatic of the human condition. You get it in politics, you get it in industry, and you get it in the church. And it's really the core of very little apart from the opinions of people. It's not really the thing that brings about redemption or change or joy to any great degree. But it's there, and I suppose it's nearly impossible to get rid of. Whether the church can manage it, Well, the Catholic Church can manage it. I mean, it's already had its schisms in Christianity, but whether it can manage it within the Catholicism, I suppose, is hard to know. And I don't, not too sure we'll know that fully until we have had three or four popes kind of play out their ministry. But
well, just,
I
mean,
even
on the, you know, the balance between the role of lay people in the church and priests in the church, I mean, you've seen that from both sides. You're, you know, a layman now, but you were a priest. But I don't know whether you're in touch with many priests and, you know, what their views are, what their morale is like.
I'm in touch with a good few priests and one or two bishops, not very many bishops, mind you, but there's a... It's kind of, I get saddened by that really at the moment, because I think what's happening, I get both angry and saddened for my fellow priests, the people that I serve, the people I know, the people that I see in parishes, the parishes that I attend. I see the burden that's been put on local parish or curates and parish priests. The amount that's expected of them is almost impossible to live up to, just physically, never mind any other way. I, for example, came across a situation recently where one priest had something like 5 funerals within about 3 days. Now, in my day, you could have had a funeral and that was it. But nowadays, a priest has to go to the house, has to get to know the people. He has to quite often speak on their behalf about the person's life. And he has to embrace the emotions of those very sad days for people, and become more than a priest, almost a spokesperson for so many things. And that takes its toll. I see the tiredness in a lot of priests. Sometimes I'm surprised that the priests don't rebel a bit, right?
Over what?
Sometimes they should just say, no, this can't go on. This can't keep happening. And I see the bishops, and I'd be very critical sometimes of the bishops, because they have a responsibility. I mean, in the next couple of weeks, we'll be all looking towards Rome, and it'll be a wonderful Italia, it'll be a wonderful television spectacle, all of which is fascinating, and we'll all kind of benefit from that in some kind of way. But it's not really the importance. We can't do very much about what the Universal Church, but we could do a whole lot about the Irish Catholic Church. And I'm not too seeing all that much happening within that. And Catholic Church is incredibly hierarchical. And while that maybe had its time and its place, it's no longer capable of handling the present world. And that what it means is that the local curate doesn't say anything because it's the parish priest who holds the power, and the parish priest doesn't say anything because the bishop holds the power, and the bishop says little because they look to the Vatican and the Pope. And all of that has now become redundant. And yet we still live within that kind of prototype. And it's that prototype is incapable of change at a time in the world when change is demanded for so many different reasons.
Sorry, Dennis, to interrupt you. I mean, where does the burden lie then, you know, to change that, if it is about reinvigorating the church and lifting some of the burden off priests who have, you know, a large work program catering to, you know, wider and wider geographic areas? Whose job is it? Is it up to lay people to step up to that? Is it up to the institutional church to allow them the space to step into it?
Well, if you were talking again about change, I think that you would have to talk to the bishops, because the bishops carry the responsibility for that. The local parish priest can't do anything about that, and the laity really doesn't have any real power in the church at all. I mean, one of the things they could do, for example, which would have some response to and some tackling of what I'm talking about, the tiredness that I see in priest eyes, is that we could have far more deacons, right? We could at least appoint deacons. If we don't want to wait for Rome to decide whether there's going to be married priests or non-married priests, and whether there's going to be woman priests or no woman priests, whatever about those kind of arguments and debates that are happening within the church, and that will continue to happen and will ultimately resolve themselves, but it will take a long period of time. In the meantime, there's nothing to stop the Irish Catholic bishops appointing deacons all over the place, which would give support and things. And I think change quite often comes about best when it's incremental. It doesn't always have to be dramatic. And incrementality is a perfect example of that. I grew up in an era, and I'm sure you grew up in an era too, when women weren't allowed on the altar. And now women dominate the altar. What I mean by that is that they both clean the church, but they also give out communion and so forth, and nobody blinks an eye anymore. But they blinked an eye for about 2 months. So change, incremental change like that. And the way that parishes, I had a very good example of something recently whereby a retiring parish priest actually had worked with a group of lay people and prepared them to take over the parish. And he said to the bishop, look, you don't have anybody to replace me. Let these people run the parish. Bring in a priest every so often if you want, of course, but let these people run the parish. I have seen some of that happening in parishes in England, and it's wonderful when it works reasonably well. It is so spiritual, and it is so communal in the sense that people out of themselves are coming together to be together, to pray, and to communicate with the God that they believe in. So all of that becomes possible within the present rules and the present dynamics of the church. And we don't have to wait on this new pope. We don't have to wait on Rome to change things. Right. And we don't have to wait on the hierarchical processes to actually bring about this change. It can be done here in Ireland at this moment of time, and it should be done for both the sake of the church and for the men at the moment, because it's only men who actually try to meet the needs of people who are crying out for, well, some of them at least are crying out to be involved and to be part of their church.
All right. We have a woman on the line, as it happens. Kate Boylan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Cullum.
Yeah, your thoughts on Pope Francis?
Well, listening there to Dennis Bradley, he said a great deal of what's very important. I suppose I would just complement it by emphasising what I understand of the synodality process, because I think that there's great hope in that.
Would you initiated by the Pope? Would you maybe explain that just for people who aren't familiar?
It is an effort to involve everybody in the church. And I don't like this thing of dividing clerics and, priests and people and all the rest of it. And in fact, this is very interesting that Pope Francis was very much, he spoke very strongly about clericalism. And what did he mean by clericalism? He explained himself, a kind of an elite approach. And of course, that's what we've had. And the idea of, I think the idea of the priest that Dennis Bradley there mentioned, who went to his bishop and said, look, the people can run this church, and he's seen it in England. But it takes an initiative on the part of somebody who has enough of the given authority in the church, not necessarily given by the general people, but given in his hierarchical position, like a PP, to grasp that nettle and say, look, the lay people in this parish can run things.
And you're a Catholic yourself, Kate, are you? You are.
I realise, actually, I've gone off away from the synodality thing. But the synodality thing is that the Pope wanted to set up a process where everybody in the church would be involved in looking at renewal and in, you know, progressing towards real renewal. And of course, it's a slow process. But there were meetings in parishes, and then from the parishes, people were delegated to go to, I think, diocesan and then national, and then, for example, for us, European. And then there was the big synod on synodality in Rome. And uniquely, it had quite a number of women there, who were not all of whom were religious. So you'd
be a bit more optimistic, maybe, about how far that's already progressed than maybe Dennis is, would you?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's very patchy. It would depend on diocese and even parish and country. And, of course, he talked about schism, and we have, you know, there's a problem in some, in mostly African countries, as far as I know, with some of the things that Pope Francis has said, like, for example, who am I to judge LGBT people, etc. But the and allowing a blessing, that, of course, is the key thing, allowing a blessing for couples who are LGBT. But where was I? The synod, the synodality thing.
Yeah, and the involvement
it's
of the
process,
lay people generally.
And I think a lot of it comes from the way Latin American people have approached projects in, say, in development, in developing their own social and economic situation. Sit down and talk and listen and talk and listen and talk and listen. And it can be very slow.
And do you have any view as to, you know, who might be best placed to carry on the work of Pope Francis in that direction? Or, I mean, are you less concerned with personalities?
Well, unfortunately, I think the personality will matter a lot. I think it will matter a lot. It mattered a lot with Pope Francis. He was so people-centred and so, you know, modest in his lifestyle and all that sort of thing, and accessible in the lifestyle, because he, you know, went around corridors and up and down and ate with people and so on at a communal table. So, of course, again, cleric, priests and so on. But still, that's better than being in all alone in a fancy apartment or with some Monsignor. So I would be optimistic, yeah. I think maybe the fact that Pope Francis declared this year, 2025, to be a jubilee year on the theme of hope, that Catholics are invited to be pilgrims of hope during this year of jubilee. And maybe I've been sort of affected by that, but I do feel hopeful, because I think he's set in motion something, and it can't really be stopped. I don't see how the next pope could justify himself saying, no more synods on synodality. I think that would be, there we'd be on the way to a schism probably, or schism, or however you say it. So that's basically, those are the sort of general thoughts I have, Colm.
Right. And you sound like you're somebody who's pretty active yourself.
Yeah, reasonably, yes. I read in church, and I belong to a wonderful choir. We sing at morning mass on Sundays. And in our particular parish, and it has happened around the place, there's one day of the week where there is no mass, and a layperson looks after a service of the word of God, and so the readings and so on of the day, and that in and with Holy Communion. Now, there are people who think that theologically it's not right that Holy Communion should only be given in the context of the Mass, where the communion is as it were created, is consecrated, but this is the model that has been adopted, I think, in most places where this kind of thing is done. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I do one of those.
Right.
And it doesn't have a huge attendance, less maybe than the daily Mass on the other days, but pretty respectable at the same time.
And any view, have you been keeping an eye on who the potential candidates to succeed Pope Francis are? Anyone you'd favour yourself, and why, if so?
Well, to be honest, I can't claim to know too much about the eligible the cardinals who can elect, and therefore among themselves probably will elect someone from among their ranks. But there's one certainly that I've heard mentioned and came across at the Eucharistic Congress some years back, is Cardinal Tagle of the Philippines, Manila in the Philippines. A very personable chap altogether, very speaks very well, and you can Google or look him up on YouTube. A very good communicator. He's probably pretty conservative. I mean, I think most of the cardinals would be, most bishops are sort of maybe I'd say he'd be a bit more in the model, perhaps, of Pope Francis himself, who really effectively was quite conservative in a lot of ways.
Too conservative for your liking?
No, not really. But I mean, I suppose I'd like to see a bit more movement on the question of women as deacons and priests, you know. But whether, I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of that. He probably was very wise to go slowly on that, because it could cause, you know, it could cause division in the church, as indeed it did in the Anglican Church to some degree, in that they have, in England, as far as I know, they still have a sort of, what would you call it? I was going to say digital, but a non-geographic diocese for people who wouldn't accept women priests.
All right, and indeed some of those people have migrated back to the Catholic Church after, I suppose, many centuries after the schism there. John McCourt, you're in Rome. Where were you when you heard the news that Pope Francis had died? Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, John, how are you?
Yes.
Could you hear me there?
How are you?
Yeah, where were you when you heard the Pope had died?
I was at home in Italy, in a place called Macerata, in the Marche, former papal state. So I heard it first thing the other morning.
And would you have kept an eye on the Pope, you know, and his activities during your time in Italy? Is it something you're plugged into?
Oh, very much so, yeah. We would have been very aware that he was clearly struggling with his health. Watching him on Easter Sunday was almost painful. He just looked so in distress, and yet he was fighting till the end, trying to do his job. And so, yeah, we were very much aware. I think, as some people have said, it was a shock, but not a surprise that, you know, he slipped away yesterday morning.
Right, you're the rector of the University of Macerata. We should stress that that's an academic rather than a clerical title.
Oh, very much so. It's a state university, the University of Macerata. We've been here since 1290, so it's one of the oldest universities in Europe, and it's not a religious institution, no, it's a state university.
How long have you been there yourself? Not obviously since 1290.
Not quite that long. I've been in Italy for 35 years, in various places, in Trieste, in Rome, and now in the Marche, in Macerata.
And what do you think is coming next? From your observations of it, what direction do you think it might go in? And I know this is speculation, but I suppose informed speculation from somebody who's living in a former papal state, maybe, and has been watching the way things go in the Vatican.
Well, I think there's a genuine outburst of sorrow, to be fair, that he's gone. I think he was a pope that made people, believers and not believers, feel very, you know, very much part of things. The headline on the local paper this morning was "Uno di noi," one of us, and there was that real sense that he had an ability to communicate with people on a good natural touch that not everyone has, and certainly not all popes have had over time. So his ability, I suppose, to seem, you know, to go beyond what was often a very judgmental church to a very inclusive church. So you'd have to hope that that would continue, that somebody along those lines would step up. It's almost an impossible task trying to hold the various anime or sides of the church together, you know, the conservatives, the liberals, those who want to feel belonging but are somehow not part of things. So I think he did the almost impossible to try and keep the various sides of Catholicism together over his years, while at the same time bringing the church into the 21st century his own way of living.
And what about, you know, the big issues like climate change, like peace, like all of those kind of things? Would you be hopeful that maybe, and indeed immigration, do you think that, or would you be hopeful that the next pope would have an equal emphasis on all of those issues that Pope Francis was pretty outspoken on?
Yeah, I think the church, to remain relevant, has to speak to those issues. I think, sadly, the Pope wasn't listened to. I mean, his first visit when he became Pope was to Lampedusa, south of Italy, to meet the people from there who were welcoming with all the difficulties that that involves migrants. His Laudatio Si on climate, in which he underlined that humanity and the planet have to somehow find a way of getting on with each other, and that we have to take care of what we've been given, is a crucial message, and one that many of us shared and share, but which seems increasingly to be put aside. And then his constant pleas for peace. Let's not forget that his last message was appealing for peace, appealing for an end to the hostilities in Gaza. The Pope has to try and stand up for what's right in that sense. He has to stand up for both good sense and everything else. So you'd have to hope that his message lives on, that whoever follows him is even more incisive in making his message heard, because he is one voice. But the world desperately needs voices like his right now.
All right, Dennis Bradley, finally, on the issue of peace and the importance of having a high-profile figure who's willing to speak truth to power and maybe say the unpopular things when it comes to trying to achieve peace in conflicts. How important is that? Hello, Dennis.
All right. Yeah, this is John. Yeah.
All right. Okay, we'll take a break. We're back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And you can get us on 087 484 8888 for WhatsApp. Cullum O'Mungoyne here. Simon Moore, good afternoon to you.
Hey, Cullum, how are you doing?
How's the hand? Will you tell us 3 or 4 weeks?
Yeah, 4 weeks now, yeah.
Yeah.
Four weeks.
What happened?
Go on. So basically I was using a skill saw, and lucky enough I was at home, self-employed, of course. You never stop working. So I was cutting a bit of wood in the garden for, I do water treatment. So it was putting on like a UV treatment kind of system. We just make them up. So it's just easier, obviously, when you're out and you work for yourself, it's easier to get everything prepared and ready to go for when you're going to onto the job. You save time, obviously. Save time is money, as they say.
All right. Yeah. And a skill saw for anyone who's not initiated with the tool set. Are you talking about, is it an electric saw or a power saw?
It's it's not an electric one. So the one that I have is battery operated. Lucky enough, it didn't have that much power in it. So as I was cutting the piece of wood, split second distraction got in the way, and it was probably rushing myself as well, because I just wanted to get it done, and it was Sunday, so I just wanted to get it done,
get the job out of the way, get it done.
The left hand got in the way and the skill saw went through the finger, so the finger was detached, not completely detached from my hand. As I remember, I'm just getting flashbacks.
Take your time. But you know, obviously, it was it must have been a massive shock, was it?
It was horrible. Oh, it was horrible. Not at the time. Shock didn't hit me for about a week and a half after. Really.
And what was
you're blind to it, you know.
I mean, could you believe what you were seeing?
No. No. So as you say that, like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Up until a week and a half after the accident, I was convinced to myself that there was no blood. So I had convinced myself there was no blood, and then a week and a half later, it came back to me, and the blood was quite bad. I won't go into too much detail.
No, but
you're
a plumber, as it happens. So you know, yeah. did you have any? Not to be indelicate about it, but you know, it wouldn't be the first leak you'd fixed if you had to do. What did you do? Did you have to reach for tape or what to kind of patch yourself up
so
to stabilize?
I ran down straight away. So the finger was hanging off my hand. So I just grabbed the finger and repositioned it back where it should be. And then I just ran down to my wife. My kids are in the house. I didn't go in because I knew they would have been traumatized, you know. So I just screamed for my wife, just help, 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 help. I'm not cutting my finger off. And she came out. She was, of course, shocked, you know. So I got her to get a towel. Yeah, as a plumber, yeah, thinking, stop the leak, of course. I didn't want to pass out either because I'm 85 kilo man.
Right.
6 foot tall. I didn't want her to have to drag me out or try to do something. So she got a towel anyway, and we got a towel, and I got her to tie it as tight as possible in my forearm. Just to stop, I suppose, just to try and slow down the bleeding. And then another towel, as I had my hands in kind of prayer position, holding my finger on, another towel around that, and then we went down to Lochinstown Hospital.
And while all of this is going on, you're presumably trying to be reasonably calm at the same time as communicating the urgency of it, but, you know,
yeah,
trying to keep the kids calm as well. What age are they?
Oh, the kids were, so my mother, she lives in the same house, and, well, next door, so to speak. So they're 11 and 8. And the minute when I ran in, they ran. So they ran into my mother's house, and they were hiding. So my eldest girl, she hated behind the sofa. She was terrified. Where the second child is, you know, a little bit more resilient.
And how did Granny react?
Shock as well. So she didn't. We were gone already by the time that she even knew what was going on. We were already in the car, and we were gone down the road. We were gone. So my wife rang that. She called my mother, and because the kids obviously came in, and they told the nana that daddy had cut his finger off, you know. And then it's kind of like worst case scenario. We mother didn't know what was going on, you know.
So, I mean, you gave her, you told her what had happened. You gave her, what, some level of reassurance that the finger was still attached, but only barely so, did you?
Well, when I say attached, I mean, like, it was 98% off my hand. It was hanging on.
Right.
Mm.
So what are you thinking on the way to the hospital? Let's just get there, is it?
There was no thinking, I don't think. There was no thinking. I kind of had my head between my knees, and I just kept saying sorry to my wife. I just kept apologising to her. Just kept telling her I was sorry, you know.
I mean, that's probably just the shock reaction, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And no, I mean, the pain as well. That's a funny thing. The pain didn't kick in for maybe 10 minutes after it happened. And by the time I got down to the hospital then, it was... I could feel it.
I take it you weren't waiting long by the time you hit the hospital, were you?
No. They were really good. I mean, really good. Straight through. And you know, people say they're waiting a long time in A&E. No. This was straight in the door, straight into the medical room. There was 5-6 doctors around me.
Yeah, but there's that, you know, like, I know from bringing people with far less serious injuries, there's that bit where you take back the bandage to show the doctors injury.
Yeah.
And that's the second time around.
I had my hand, I was holding my finger on, basically. And the nurse, she says to me, just let go of the hand now. And I was so afraid to, you know, the fear of letting go of my finger. Because I was like, I'm not holding this on. But they gave me like 6 or 7 injections, nerve injections on my hand, and then it was grand. They worked away in it.
How long was it before they got to work on it and trying to kind of reconnect nerves and tendons? And I'm not going to display my ignorance in medical matters.
24 hours. 24 hours.
So
I went from Lochinstown to Vincent's, and they were really good there as well. But obviously you have to wait for, there's other people in there that are more urgent than you. You know yourself. I mean, right. 24 hours. They were really good.
I'd say it was hard to find out somebody who was more urgent than you after all that. they'd want to be, yeah, well.
I'm still even talking about it. I get the shakes. I'm shaking even now thinking about it, you know.
Yeah, sure, of course. It's a major life trauma.
Yeah.
And come here, when was the, to put it in context, when's the first bit of good news do you think you got? Did anyone give you an assessment as to what your recovery would be?
Because...
Sorry, Simon, you just broke up a little bit there. I was just asking, you know, did you get any encouraging news as to whether or not it was reattached or anything, or what was the first bit of positive news you got from the medical teams?
So I was waiting for No, I mean, it was pretty encouraging from the start. Even so, as they had my hand in the cast before, I had.
All right. Your line is breaking up a bit there, Sam. We're going to take a wee break. We're back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Refresh your home this spring with new curtains. Explore our stylish collection now at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungon here talking to Simon Moore, who just at the end of March severed his finger with a skill saw while he was working in the garden. So you made it to Vincent's anyway, Simon, and it's which finger? Is the little finger on your left hand, is it?
So it's the little finger on the left hand.
The left hand, right. So the medical team reasonably optimistic at the beginning, were they could do something
reasonably
for you?
Reasonably optimistic at the beginning, yeah. So as I said, sorry, you don't already hear me, that's when we broke up. So they were coming in early and squeezing each finger because it was in a cast at the time, obviously because it was just an emergency, they had to just cast it and make sure it was just sitting still. And they'd come in early and they'd squeeze each finger, and then they get to the pinky finger and they'd squeeze the tip of the finger. It was detached basically at that stage, just sitting there. But I could feel it, and I mean I could feel it. So that was amazing that I could still feel it. So they told me there was still one nerve and one blood vessel feeding the finger at the time, which was a blessing.
And where was the finger severed? Was it near the bottom or the middle of the top or where?
So if you look at your hand and look at the very first knuckle up from your hand, went through that one.
So the main knuckle?
Yeah, the main bendy knuckle. So as it went through that one, it got entangled in the saw, which is like it's a miracle as well that I still have it on my hand. So it cut, imagine like a spiral from that point up to the kind of tip.
Oh, God.
So it's stitched all the way around and have tendons reattached. What they can do now is amazing. But as I say, it's fused.
You say that with at the admiration of a skilled tradesman. You can't, your pain, you're still able to imagine.
Totally. Yeah, but like, I can't bend it. It's still attached, but it affects the ring fingers. So now I have a problem with the ring finger. The ring finger will only bend halfway, but the top knuckle on my ring finger won't bend. So I don't know, as a plumber needs his two hands to grip. For let's say you have a fitting, and you have two wrenches, a wrench in your left hand and a wrench in your right hand, and you have to loosen or tighten that fitting. I don't know if I'm going to have grip in the left hand anymore. So that's worrying, but it could have been worse.
Well, I mean,
all the fingers could be gone, you know.
Sure, and that's relative. But look, this all happened on a Sunday. First thing Monday, you've probably got a program of work to do and lads working
with you.
You have to ring around everybody and say, we have a bit of an issue here.
Yeah. Now, we did have a guy before Christmas, but he had to leave due to family circumstances. And then it was down to myself, and it was fine. I had kind of got into a rhythm. And then, obviously, this happened, and I just...
Right.
I think it's like it's you just feel like you did let so many people down, you know, and it gets in on you as well.
But, I mean, you've been paying self-employed people's PRSI, I think, 4.1% since October. So did you have any hope that maybe there might be something in the tank there while you were undergoing your recovery?
I thought maybe because they had all this kind of talk about PRSI and was there talk just after Christmas there was some sort of they were talking about looking after self-employed people for illness cover, but I know that covers €450 and only 75% of that then will be covered if you're earning up to €450. But with everything that had happened with the company and working for myself, sometimes you have a sore back. Sometimes you might be sick. Sometimes you have family stuff. And you always find yourself trying to claw yourself, trying to get yourself to a certain point, and then you just be knocked down again. And now I'm just being totally knocked off.
Right. And okay, you didn't have any separate serious illness cover or anything else that would have covered an incident like this, right?
I mean,
you rang the department, did you, or got in contact with
the department? I got in contact with the department. They will only cover you if you're so unmarried, and because you're combined assessed. They'll only cover you if your partner earns a certain amount, but they won't cover any. They won't cover you then, because your partner works.
So you gave your PBS number, and they checked your entitlement, and you were told no. Yeah. Is that it?
No, I was told nothing. Yeah. Basically, told me that I would not get on. And I even went to my local councillor. I tried to get him to see if there was anything that he talked to the minister, and the same thing came back. No help. Because of the class of PRSI that myself and my fellow tradespeople, farmers.
This is class S PRSI.
Class S PRSI, yeah. Most people are in class A, if people aren't aware. It's class A that most people pay, and that's 8.9%.
8.9, I think the employer pays, yeah.
And I mean, my main point with this is, why is there no option for sole traders or people in trades or farmers, or in my situation, why is there no option for us to pay Class A, 8.9%? I mean, I wouldn't mind paying 20%. You know, if it covered me for this type of injury.
I mean, and it's a tough time to learn the limits of Class S, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, I've been spreading the word to all my trade friends, all my friends in the trades, lots of them. I know, because we're the lifeblood of the economy.
Look, I'm sure there's plenty of people listening who have a huge amount of sympathy for you, but I mean, the bad luck didn't stop there. A week ago,
no,
your van was broken into.
Yeah. It's just outside the door, and they took all my tools. So now, my ability, even if I go back to work, my ability to try and make money again is gone. It's gone, you know.
And you don't have any obvious, you know, clear timeline for going back to work. You don't even know if that's a possibility at this stage.
Don't know. Well, they say July, August, maybe by the time their finger will be. See, there's lots of rehabilitations to do here as well. I'm just kind of.
And are you plugged in anywhere for that rehabilitation? Are you, you know, do you have a place, or is that something you'll have to wait around to get?
I don't know. I presume it'll be. I don't know. I presume it'll be dumped to the hospital. I mean, and that's fantastic. From PRSI covers that. You know, I'd be lost. Jesus, if we needed to pay that separately, we'd be goosed. And right. then yesterday, as I was saying to one of the lads who rang me, if a tyre breaks in the car, or a tyre goes in the car, or something unexpected now happens, we're goosed.
We did put into the department for a response. So PRSI and Class S gives you access to adoptive benefit, guardian's payment, job seeker's benefit, invalidity pension, maternity benefit, parent benefit, partial capacity benefit, paternity benefit, state pension, treatment benefit, widows, widowers, surviving civil partners, contributory pension. But the benefits to which Class S PRSI does not provide access are carer's benefit, health and safety benefit, illness benefit, and occupational injuries benefit. So that the latter two, really, in your case, are the relevant ones there.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's common for tradespeople to hurt themselves. You know, when I was in the hospital, I met many other people who have injured their hands, and mostly trades, carpenters, electricians. I met another plumber who he completely went through his hand, and he lost the complete ability to lose.
Did he recover?
Get in contact with him again. I don't know.
Right.
See, this had just happened when I was in there, so I don't know.
Anyway,
his whole hand.
So, you obviously want, you'd be keen to get your tools recovered, but you're also putting the call out that you think people who are self-employed should be entitled to a bit more, and as you say, you would be happy to pay the increased contribution if your entitlements 100%. Were improved.
Oh my God! Just give us the option.
Make it an option.
Even if they charge 25-30%, there's nothing safeguarding us here, and it brings you to a very dark place.
And where does it leave you financially, Simon? I mean, the bills are still, the bills still have to be paid.
I mean, lucky enough, the one saving grace as well is we are mortgage free. But if we had a mortgage, I don't know what we'd do. I don't know. I really don't know. We still have electricity bills, €600. You still have, and they're crazy, crazy electricity. Still have to heat the house. Mm. Still have to eat. And I feel a lot of pressure on my wife. You know?
The kids must be very relieved to see you back, though, back from the hospital.
Yeah.
When you did arrive back.
Yeah.
And your mum, were they?
Very, yeah. They were delighted to see me back.
Yeah. Did you tell them the story about the finger being checked? They haven't been looking to squeeze your little finger since to check the feeling on it, have they?
No, they haven't. No, thankfully.
Oh God, I hope they're not listening then.
No, they're down.
Right. Tell,
playing Minecraft.
Yeah. Well, that'll keep them occupied. Keep them occupied for a while. I mean, how do you feel it's going yourself, recovery-wise? You're probably watching it every day closely to see if there's any improvement, are you?
But with the index finger, this has only kind of started the last few days that I'm kind of losing. I think it's because they were splinted together. You know, kind of one piggybacks the other one in the splinter they have. But I mean, I can't believe it now. And I think that has to do with the tendon that piggybacks the other finger.
Right.
You kind of need your. So if you try to do it here yourself.
Right.
To put your hand up.
Yeah.
And bend your ring finger.
Yes.
And then try and bend that ring finger all the way down to touch your. Bend the top knuckle. Bend the top knuckle without bending your small finger.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't do it.
No,
so they're together.
I'm trying there. I'm getting a bit of budge, but not much. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I am with that one. But I'll wait. We'll just wait and see. I'm not going to.
Right. Well, listen, I just hang on there. John Phelan's on the line there. John, good afternoon to you.
How are you going?
Similar, what Simon is saying there, you had a similar experience, albeit not with the saw.
No, I dropped a steel cover on my finger and severed the middle finger on my right hand. But I just say that chap there, like, you'd be surprised how quick you adapt to it. Like, you know what I mean? Once the initial pain goes out of it, like, you learn how to change the way you do things to, you know what I mean, to get going again, like, you know what I mean.
And was yours ever reattached, John?
No, when I chopped it off, I didn't realise it gone for a minute, then I just saw the blood on the machine, then I looked at the hand and I saw the finger gone, so then I had to start the machine to find the finger, and when I found the finger, the top of the finger, then my daughter brought me to A&E. So she dropped me at the door, and I ran into, I was in triage, they were kind of starting to put me back together, whatever, and I could hear, next thing I heard her out in the public area, "It's okay," she said, "I have his finger here in the bag."
And did they bring it in? Did they try and reattach it?
Oh, they did, yeah.
Right.
Well, no, they looked and they said there's too much damage.
Right.
Too, like, so they couldn't reattach it. But I mean, she said that she had taken a video then of the finger before they started bandaging up. So then when the doctor came to see, she said, I'll have to ask you to unwrap it again. My daughter said, "I have the video here." So, "Oh, that's my grand." So she showed her the video and said, "No, so there's too much damage done to the finger." And they couldn't reattach it. So I had surgery then the following morning. They tidied up the end of it. But
Were you in overnight?
I was just in overnight, yeah. And back to work then the following day.
Back to work?
Oh, my God.
Back to work with what?
Well, milking cows, like, I mean.
And do you not need both hands for that?
Well, you do, yeah. But sure, you just wear a plastic glove and it's fine.
And there was
I'm like that chap there. I'm self-employed. Like, I mean,
yeah.
I don't have a soul to put in.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I totally get it. I would go back to work now if I could carry stuff, but it's fingers in the way now.
You'll learn to adapt.
I kind of had to go, yeah.
Yeah, you will learn to adapt. You'll be surprised, actually, how quickly you will learn to adapt. I mean, I'm left-handed, which is, a blessing in one way, but, I mean, you still need both hands for a lot of work, but your mind adapts and your body adapts, you know what I mean? You'd be surprised how you say, geez, I couldn't do that, but you will do it, you know what I mean? Your mind figures out, you can't do A, but you can do B, so.
And would you be doing that kind of maintenance work yourself around the farm, John, where you'd need, two hands, maybe, one holding a wrench and another holding a spanner or whatever, two tools at the one time?
Yeah, and the other one scratching my head to try and figure out what I've done, what I've to get to do.
Yeah,
you never have enough hands. Again, that chap there, he's a plumber. It's the same thing. You never have enough hands, but if you damage one, it's.
But John, you shouldn't be in that position. You shouldn't be in that position that you can't rest to heal yourself without having. Because you pay your PS, you pay your PSI. You're a farmer.
Well, I do.
You're class S as well. You should have to, even for 2 weeks to have a look. I'm after chopping my finger off. I need to deal with this mentally as well. John, it does get you.
And physically, John, how long did it take you to actually, before the pain had died away and maybe your hand was back working to at least some of the level that it was working to before? I mean, how long would you say the physical recovery took overall?
I'd say a matter of weeks, really. Once I just kept it clean, I didn't get an infection. And that was that was the big worry to have, because when you chop off your finger, you expose the bone. So, once they drag the flesh back over the bone, you're still prone to infection.
You weren't worried that the plastic glove you were using would tear or anything out while you were out doing the milking or anything?
No. Sure, but I'm double one if I need it. I was just careful.
This was something that when I was in the hospital at the time just after the accident, and they had my finger in the hand. They asked me the question. They said, "Do you want to keep it or do you want to just we can two options here? You can reattach it because there was still blood going to it, and it's a good chance it's going to take, or we can take it off." And in my head, the same thing. I was like, "Oh my God, I'm going to be out of work. I won't have any money coming in. I'll just get rid of it.
Yeah.
I don't need another finger. I'll just get rid of it." Because the recovery would have been quicker. It would have been quicker. I know it would have been quicker in my own head.
Yeah.
But why should I give up one of my fingers for the sake of money as well?
Absolutely, yeah.
And mentally, John, I mean, I know you say, physically you're back, you went back the next day, and there's probably part of that is necessity, and probably part of it is as much shock as anything else. You just, you get back in the groove and you start doing it. But I mean, did it play in your mind at all? What would you say the mental impact was?
Not really, no. The only impact was that I said, and how I lost that finger, because the way my hand was, I should really have lost my thumb. Now, that chap there will tell you, if you lose your thumb, you may as well lose your whole hand.
Game over, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I did ask him when they were doing the surgery, could I look at it while they were fixing it? And he said no. He said they don't allow it in case you have trauma. And I said, it doesn't matter, bother me. Which I said, that's okay then.
Right. But Simon, you saw it happening in real time as well, Simon. And look, trauma is one of those things. Everybody reacts differently to it. Some people have one reaction. It's a very personal thing, and it doesn't say anything about strength or weakness in anyone. It's just a very personal thing, and you don't know what the reaction is going to be until it actually happens. I mean, people who are survivors of all sorts of things would testify to that. But I mean, mentally, Simon, apart from the physical injury, you can see the argument for there being a bit of supported recovery time to help people, even with those aspects of things.
Definitely,
it does make a difference. Like that, you get back to doing something as quick as you can. With the medical advice, but I mean, it does your mind good, and it does does the body good. Like, I mean, the body has to learn. It does a, you know, the body has to learn to adapt, and it'll do your mind good. Like, because, well, I'm not completely incapacitated, and then you find things you can. Things might be a bit more difficult, but you'll figure it out. Like, you'll work it out very quickly.
Right, and what Simon was saying there, John, you know, about nearly the immediate thought was to apologise to people and think about getting back to work. Were you pretty much the same yourself? Is that what was going through your mind?
Not really, no, because it was my own fault. Like, I should have been more careful what I was doing. So it was more of, you know, that was a stupid thing to do. Like, you know what I mean? There wasn't any real. More if I could have kicked myself in the ass, I would have done it more often, but. My own thoughts, like, so.
Right. And you have a daughter, and I mean, you have dependents then anyway, do you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a wife and three kids. Like, well, I have two daughters that are nurses. And she's the older girl. She's a psychiatric nurse. So she said, no problem. She'll look after me. She'll pick a nice nursing home. And she said.
And Simon, your own family, I mean, you've, as you say, you're living in the house, your wife and your mother, not in the immediately same part of the house as you, and yeah. You've got the kids there. I mean, the family support must be some comfort that, you know, you've got the people
totally,
you love
totally,
around
totally.
You.
It's the unknown, and it's just the lack of support. The lack of support for finances, even 20 euro, even food stamps, vouchers, or something to help along the way, because it, like I said to you, now my ability to even work is gone because the tools are gone as well. On top of it, you know it.
You really got a double mammy there, aren't you?
And is the van in need of much repair? Was there damage done when it was broken into?
They used some sort of scanner, some device to get in, because the alarm didn't go off when they got in. And then the employee that they had last year, his van was there and was trying to sell that, and they came to smash the windows and that. And they smashed the windscreen in the big one as well. So I'm waiting to get that done, and that's going to be a couple of weeks because the garage, they have to recalibrate.
All right. It's just, well, come here, hold that thought for a minute. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you in a sec.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Neil Ring, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colin.
How are you?
Good, good.
We put the call out there before the programme for people who'd met Pope Francis. You're one of those people.
Yes, I was I was very privileged in 2018, 2019. I was Lord Mayor of Dublin, and obviously, the Pope arrived in very early in my term, and Dermot Martin I had met him as part of the, you know, you go around, you meet the bishop, you meet the ambassador, you meet the Taoiseach, etc., as Lord Mayor. And he more or less promised me that this time, because in 79, John Paul II was supposed to stop in Sean McDermott Street, and he promised me that he'd get Pope Francis to do that at Our Lady of Lourdes Church, right in the heart of the inner city. So he was good on his promise. We had all gathered there. Of course, the mammy had the hair done and the good frock on. She's still living off that, meeting the Pope. Yeah.
Did you have the hair brushed and the good suit on?
Colin, there isn't too much to brush. Even at that stage, there wasn't much to brush. But it was just a very moving, and it was just a beautiful. He got out of the Pope Mobile. Archbishop Martin brought him over to a table. I think they looked at the relics of Matt Talbot. And then he just literally just walked over to the crowd and just went along, and it was just so beautiful.
What did it mean to the local people?
It was so lovely. There was a girl beside me, and she has a handicapped child who was in the wheelchair, paraplegic, and the Pope put his hand on the girl's head and said a prayer or gave her a blessing. And the little girl smiled, and her mother just said, she nearly burst into tears. She said, I had never seen her smiling. And everyone around who knew the little girl, the girl in the wheelchair, were just, like, people still talk about it. And they still talk about that visit. Anyone who was there at Sean McDermott Street, it was just, it was, it was, he was such a man of the people, and this is where he showed it to the people of Dublin's North Inner City. It was just amazing. He just oozed this. Well, as I said to your researcher, he knew he was a lot closer to God than myself or anyone else who was there. He was just a holy man, and caring, and just charismatic. I mean, you just said hello to him, and you just felt, I've just met someone really, really important, and an absolutely beautiful person as well. It was just, I had some great highlights as my year of Lord Mayor. The Dubs won 4 in a row. We had the first Dáil anniversary. We had great things going on.
Was that better than all of them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sure, we even had two of the Windsors. Harry and Meghan came over at a visit, and I met them. And sure, that's a talent.
We won't tell them you said that. All right, Neil Ring, thanks a million for telling us that. All right, we have a short break to take. Back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.